From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un prepare to meet in Singapore.
The complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of the Korea Peninsula is the only outcome that the United States will accept.
Plus, in 2007, the federal government settled with Purdue Pharma for misleading advertising of its powerful opioid OxyContin.
Well, the makers of OxyContin have been prosecuted, pled guilty, paying a multi-million-dollar fine. No one from the company is going to jail.
But a stunning new report from the New York Times finds that federal prosecutors wanted to pursue charges that could have led to prison sentences for some Purdue execs, but that never happened. We'll find out why. Also, what's really happening with migrant parents and their children on the southern border? We'll talk with a Boston Globe reporter about what she saw in Texas. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In just about 6 hours, President Donald Trump expects to sit down with North Korea's Kim Jong-un in Singapore. The first 45 minutes of this meeting will be one-on-one, just translators in the room with Trump and Kim. The usual contingent of top-level policy advisors, including National Security Advisor John Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, and White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, will not be in the room for those critical first moments. They'll join the president after the first 45 minutes. However, here is what Pompeo told reporters in Singapore this morning.
Sanctions will remain until North Korea completely and verifiably eliminates its weapons of mass destruction programs. If diplomacy does not move in the right direction, and we are hopeful that it will continue to do so, those measures will increase. President Trump recognizes Chairman Kim's desire for security and is prepared to ensure that a North Korea free of weapons of mass destruction is also a secure North Korea.
Joining me now on the line is Gary Seymour. He's Executive Director for Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University. He's also former White House Coordinator for Arms Control and Weapons of Mass Destruction. He served in that post in the first Obama administration. Gary Seymour, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with us via Skype today is Vipin Narang. He's president of he's professor of political science at MIT, specializing in nuclear proliferation and South Asian security. Vipin Narang, welcome to you.
Thank you, Meghna. Great to be here.
So let me just first get a sense from both of you about what you make of these critical first 45 minutes between President Trump and Kim Jong-un that's going to happen with only translators in the room. I mean, Gary, is that bold, risky? What do you think?
Well, it's normal. I mean, that's the kind of behavior you often have in summits, that the leaders will have a private meeting before they open it up to the official meeting with all of the advisors. I think Kim Jong-un's objective has to be to convince Trump that he's serious and sincere about giving up his nuclear weapons, even if he really isn't. He's got to convince Trump that in a process in exchange for peace and prosperity, North Korea is willing to first limit and eventually eliminate its nuclear weapons. Mm.
Vipin Narang, I take Gary Seymour's point about this, the one-on-one being normal in a normal summit situation. But on the other hand, Gary, I actually think it was you who a while ago told us, he told us that this isn't exactly a normal summit, right? Because a summit usually happens after months of negotiations between envoys from either side, and that is not what we have in this case. So do you think that there are risks to this first one-on-one meeting? Vipin Narang, that one's for you.
So, I mean, I think the Trump administration has turned this process upside down. In the past, negotiations between the United States and North Korea have been bottom-up. So you've had working-level groups meeting for a long time, and there's never been a U.S. president sitting down with a chairman from North Korea. And so I suspect that the aim of this meeting is to have a top-down process. So I suspect that today in Singapore, the working-level group, Ambassador Sung Kim on our side and his North Korean counterparts, probably hammered out what I expect or suspect is a pretty anodyne joint statement. It's 25 years to the day that there was a 1993 joint declaration between the U.S. and North Korea. And if you look that up, I imagine language is going to be very similar, committing to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, a security assurance from the United States. But the meeting, I think, is probably to set the framework and the guidance going forward now for the working level groups on both sides to implement a broad framework for the two sides. And, you know, I think one of Kim Jong-un's objectives was to get the photo op of the handshake with U.S. president. In a lot of ways, that confers legitimacy on him. And also the fact that he's a de facto nuclear weapons power.
Mm-hmm.
I don't expect that North Korea is going to relinquish its nuclear weapons, but now the process of, you know, at least maybe trying to cap, freeze, declare facilities can move forward.
Right. So to that point, Gary Seymour, I mean, today in Singapore, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, you know, he noted the fact, these are his words, that, quote, many presidents previously have signed off on a piece of paper only to find the North Koreans didn't promise what we had, what we thought they had, or actually reneged on their promises. And yet Pompeo also points out, as we heard in that tape a moment ago, that the ultimate goal out of these talks is the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So, I mean, what kind of immediate steps do you think have to happen in this meeting in order to get us even a little bit towards that?
So I agree with Secretary of State Pompeo that the history of U.S. negotiations with North Korea is a very sad history of cheating and broken promises. I'm not sure it's going to be different this time. I agree with Vipin that North Korea is very unlikely to give up its nuclear weapons, although they might be willing to accept some significant limits,
right,
such as limits on additional production of nuclear weapons or long-range missiles. And the key there is really going to be declaration and verification. So what I would look for very early in any agreement, which may take months or years to negotiate, is that North Korea would be required to take early steps to declare all of its existing stockpile and production facilities subject to international inspection, and then to freeze those facilities. Now, of course, we're going to have to give them something in return,
mm-hmm.
and the current U.S. negotiating position, which is North Korea satisfies us before they get any sanctions relief, that's just not practical. So somewhere along the way in the negotiations, we're going to have to figure out how to slice and dice sanctions relief and economic assistance in exchange for early, substantial, verified steps from North Korea. If they can come up with an agreement that does that, I think that would be a significant achievement, even if it never ends up in complete elimination.
Vipin Narang, what's your take?
Yeah, no, I agree entirely with Gary. And I think, you know, the one trap we need to avoid, I think, is there's the very public pronouncement of not just complete, verifiable, irreversible. So the original CVID was dismantlement, and it called for unilateral disarmament and dismantlement of the North Korean nuclear program. But the administration's public stance is not only that North Korea needs to eliminate its nuclear weapons program, but its chem, bio, ballistic missile programs. And then Secretary Pompeo has what I call the Pompeo special. He's mishmashed two of these phrases into complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And by adding those latter qualifiers, it actually could be interpreted by the North as something as extreme as universal disarmament, in the sense that the only way to irreversibly and verifiably completely denuclearize the Korean Peninsula is if the United States and everyone else also gives up its nuclear weapons. I worry this phrase is potentially a trap for the United States going forward, and it's one that hasn't been used before. So we've traded CVID originally as dismantlement, and now combined it with the old phrase denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula into a single, long and broad concept that actually could impose extreme conditions on the United States as well. And I think we have to be very careful going forward about how the North interprets the language out of any joint statement tomorrow to their advantage.
Interesting. So, Gary Seymour, let me ask you, in the Los Angeles Times, Sumi Terry of the Center for Strategic and International Studies and Bruce Klinger of the Heritage Foundation essentially point out that they believe what the Trump administration is trying to achieve with North Korea is a deal that would actually have to be tougher and more comprehensive than the Iran deal, which the United States just pulled out of. So, I mean, given that the president called the Iran deal one of the worst deals that the United States has ever entered in the history of the nation, what does that make you think about the concessions that the Trump administration is willing to make regarding North Korea?
So I think a big difference between North Korea and Iran is that North Korea will agree on paper to an end process that is complete denuclearization, including their fuel cycle facilities. They'll never actually do it, but they will agree to it on paper. The Iranians were not willing to agree, even in theory, that they would give up all of their facilities that could potentially produce fissile material. So they insisted on sunset clauses and retaining those capabilities, which they claim are for civilian purposes. So in one respect, you might get a deal on paper with North Korea that looks better than the Iran deal. I think where the real challenge will be getting any kind of an inspection regime that's even close to the Iranian inspection regime. The North Koreans have never been willing to allow any inspection outside of their declared nuclear facilities at Yongbyon. So, and of course, the Iran deal allows for inspection outside of declared facilities. That's going to be an amazing challenge. And if you throw in missiles and chemical and bio, you've just made the inspection and verification challenge many times more difficult.
Right. Vipin Narang, we've just got a minute to go here. So the last question goes to you. I mean, I just want to underscore once again that this meeting basically, as both of you have said, turns on its head decades of U.S. foreign policy and posture towards any kind of summit with a North Korean leader. So who knows what's going to happen? But President Trump is heading into this meeting after essentially having agreed to a communique out of the G7 and then deciding to disagree with it on the plane to Singapore. Could that sort of mercurial nature of the American president have any impact on how the North Koreans look at what they can get out of this first meeting?
Well, I think that that behavior kind of underscores the fundamental reason why North Korea will never give up its nuclear weapons. I mean, the reason why the Libya model created an aneurysm in North Korea is, you know, that when John Bolton insisted on North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons as a Libya model, North Korea looks at the Libya model not as 2003, but as 2011, when the United States then led, you know, the invasion and then the brutal killing of Gaddafi. And so the notion that, you know, there can be any security guarantee that is indefinitely credible that would cause North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, I think, you know, our own behavior in the past betrays that. And then, you know, and as you said, as he left the G7, the president apparently had agreed to the communique before he left and then changed his mind based on a press conference by Prime Minister Trudeau. And so all of that underscores the fact that, you know, security assurances can have expiration dates, but nuclear weapons, at least as far as the North Koreans are concerned, offer lifetime insurance.
Well, Vipin Narang is professor of political science at MIT. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magna. Thank you, Gary.
And Gary Seymour, executive director of research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Studies at Harvard. Gary Seymour, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, Cambridge's own comedy phenom, Mindy Kaling, delivered the commencement speech at Dartmouth College on Sunday. Kaling has starred in many beloved TV comedies such as The Office, The Mindy Project, and most recently on the big screen in Ocean's 8. Now, while the 2001 Dartmouth alumna earned some big laughs from the crowd, she also touched on serious issues such as the Me Too movement and her view of President Donald Trump. But between jokes, she offered the graduates her secret to success and some timely advice.
You're graduating into a world where it seems like everything is falling apart. Trust in institutions are at a record low. The truth doesn't seem to matter anymore. And for all I know, the president just tweeted us into a war with Wakanda, a country that doesn't exist. So, class of 2018, you are entering a world that we have toppled like a Jenga tower, and we are relying on you to rebuild it. But how can you do that with the knowledge that things are so unstable out there? I'll tell you my secret, the one thing that has kept me going through the years, my superpower, delusion.
Well, that was Kaling's major theme. Call it the power of positive delusion. Be delusional enough to believe that you can do whatever you set your mind to, she said, no matter what anyone else says.
I was not someone who should have the life I have now, and yet I do. I was sitting in the chair you are literally sitting in right now, and I just whispered, "Why not me?" And I kept whispering it for 17 years. And here I am, someone that this school deemed worthy enough to speak to you at your commencement. Don't let anyone tell you that you can't do something, but especially not yourself. Go conquer the world. Just remember this: why not you? You made it this far.
Mindy Kaling, speaking at the commencement exercises at Dartmouth College yesterday. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In 2007, executives at Purdue Pharma, makers of the powerful painkiller OxyContin, pleaded guilty to misdemeanor charges that they'd misbranded the powerful opioid and misrepresented its potential for abuse and addiction. Purdue paid a $634 million fine in that settlement, and it was heralded as a major victory by the federal government at the time. But a stunning recent report from the New York Times shows that prosecutors had gathered a mountain of evidence that Purdue Pharma execs knew about significant abuse of OxyContin in the first years after the drug was approved by the FDA. And prosecutors wanted to go further, according to the Times reporting. They wanted to charge top Purdue Pharma executives with felonies, including conspiracy to defraud the United States, that could have sent the executives to prison if they were convicted. But those efforts came to a grinding halt after Purdue's legal team held a previously unknown meeting with political appointees in the Justice Department, after which the government backed down. Barry Meyer reported the story for the New York Times. It also appears in his book, Painkiller, An Empire of Deceit and the Origin of America's Opioid Epidemic. The book's second edition just came out late last month, and Barry Meyer joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Barry.
Thank you, Meghna. I'm happy to be here.
This is a stunning story, and I wonder if we just might treat it simply here and kind of chronologically and march through time a little bit. So can you just start at the beginning? Just remind us briefly, when OxyContin was approved by the FDA in, what, 1995, 96, by what was the basis of its approval?
So basically, the story goes like this. In late 1995, the FDA approves OxyContin, and it gives it a unique – it allows Purdue Pharma to make a unique labeling claim for it. Essentially, it allows Purdue to say that OxyContin, because it's a long-acting form of oxycodone, a narcotic, is less – it's believed that it's less likely to be abused or cause addiction – than traditional painkillers, mm-hmm. drugs like Percocet or Vicodin.
Right.
So the FDA has never given a pharmaceutical company the ability to make this claim before. And Purdue Pharma, a very small company in Connecticut, takes this claim and starts running with it.
Well, in fact, as you report, they say that the FDA's decision is so valuable, it could be OxyContin's principal selling tool.
And it becomes that. It becomes the basic foundation for what is the largest advertising promotional campaign for a prescription narcotic in the history of the drug industry. They shower millions of dollars on doctors. They hire speakers. They do promotional events. They do junkets. And they turn it into a billion-dollar blockbuster drug.
Right.
They have doctors throughout America prescribing OxyContin for all types of pain.
So in your reports, though, I mean, you've been following this for years, and so this might be familiar to some people who have kept up with your reporting, but I do just want to, again, go tick through the years here, because it's just what? Just a couple of months, 5 months after the FDA's approval, that Richard Sackler, the head of Purdue Pharma then, is sent a medical journal describing how drug abusers were extracting morphine from another related Purdue Pharma product?
Correct. You know, essentially the whole foundation of OxyContin's marketing campaign and the approval that it received from the FDA was the concept that people that abuse drugs like to get a quick hit. So they would like drugs that acted quickly, drugs like Vicodin or Percocet. And because drugs like OxyContin acted slowly, they'd be less interested in those drugs. So Purdue made both OxyContin and it made a drug called MS-Contin, which was a long-acting form of morphine. And it was slightly after the approval of OxyContin that Purdue began receiving information that, in fact, MS-Contin was being abused, that people who were drug abusers were being drawn to it.
Okay. So we have the advantage of your reporting in 2020 hindsight, but it is stunning to hear that just in a year later, in 1998, there's this report in a Canadian journal, right, from a doctor who is actually someone who was a paid speaker for Purdue Pharma, but he published an editorial in this Canadian journal saying that contrary to the FDA's beliefs or FDA's approval for OxyContin, that long-lasting opioids such as Oxy are actually coveted by drug abusers?
That's absolutely correct, yeah. And it's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, essentially, on the one hand, you have a company, Purdue Pharma, going out and marketing this drug, telling doctors, telling patients that it's less prone to abuse. And while it is doing that, it is gathering what prosecutors found was a mountain of information that essentially all of that was untrue. It was basically a lie. So you have, you know, the fantasy that's being promoted by this company, and you have the reality, and they're two very different things. And the unfortunate effect is that, you know, this drug was prescribed at a time when people were abusing it and people were getting addicted to it.
Mm. So as you lay out in extraordinary detail in your reporting, again, there's 1998, this growing amount of evidence, as you're saying. In 1999, a Purdue sales rep says we've got a credibility problem with our product because there's more bad press around it. In that same year, the general counsel for Purdue, Howard Udell, says we have, in fact, picked up references to abuse of our opioid products on the internet. So, I mean, how much did they know, Purdue Pharma execs, before the year 2000?
According to prosecutors, and they're the ones who were able to go through millions of Purdue records and emails, they brought Purdue officials before a grand jury to testify, it was their conclusion that by 1998, so this is 3 years after OxyContin, or actually 2 years after OxyContin appeared on the market, they knew enough to basically blow the whistle, to call a timeout, to alert regulators, to alert lawmakers about what they were seeing, but they never did. And so basically you had this this catastrophe that didn't need to happen. If Purdue had acted conservatively and alerted regulators and doctors to what it was seeing.
Okay. But then in what, 2001, there is a House Appropriations Subcommittee hearing where Purdue Pharma's Vice President of Research and Development, Dr. Paul Goldenheim, essentially says they didn't know any of this. That's what he testified to. And I just want to play some tape here that he says they didn't know anything until, what, 2000 or 2001. Here's Paul Goldenheim.
In February of 2000, we got a copy of a letter that then U.S. Attorney Jay McCloskey of Maine sent to physicians in Maine, warning them of problems of OxyContin that were occurring in certain communities. And I believe it was March of that year when that was published in the Bangor Times. That was the first time we had any inclination that something different was going on that required special attention.
So that's Purdue Pharma's vice president, Dr. Paul Goldenheim, testifying in the House in 2001, saying they didn't know anything until 2000. But Barry, you and I just went through several dates that show that they knew stuff as far back as 1996, 97.
Correct. And what federal prosecutors wanted to do, the people who had actually investigated this case, was to indict Dr. Goldenheim and to indict the general counsel of Purdue and indict the chief executive of Purdue, because they believed that those statements were not true, that there was, in fact, a lot of evidence to show that the top officials of Purdue knew that the drug was being abused, and they concealed that information, or they participated in a conspiracy to conceal that information.
Well, I mean, there are so many stunning details in your reporting, Barry. You note here that in the year 2000, there was a vice president of marketing who wrote in an email saying, you know, to other Purdue Pharma execs that some pharmacies would not even stock MS-Contin, the other drug, for fear that they'd be robbed, and that in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Oklahoma, they had physicians indicted for prescribing too much. And another Purdue Pharma exec responds, do you want all this chat on email? So knowing that that it was even problematic that they were discussing it with each other.
Let me put it in the simplest possible terms. I covered this story for 17 years. I wrote a lot of stories for the Times about it. I wrote a book about it. It was about a year and a half ago that I got this report. And I can only describe my reaction as one stunned by how much prosecutors had found out about this company, what they knew about this company and its behavior, and also heartsickened by the fact that had this information come out when it should have come out, that it would have had a very powerful impact on the trajectory of the opioid epidemic. And, you know, we wouldn't be dealing with the scope of the epidemic that we are today had this information come out a decade ago.
I mean, that's a sobering thing to say, Barry, because you know Purdue Pharma, I mean, they responded to you in a statement. They sent us the exact same statement. To this day, they claim that to put that kind of responsibility on Purdue Pharma for what they call, a multifaceted, complex epidemic isn't right, that you can't uniquely blame them for this.
I don't think anyone is uniquely blaming them. But I will say this, during all the time that I've covered this story, Purdue Pharma has tried to minimize its role in it. It did it from the very beginning. But the fact of the matter is that for years and years, this company betrayed doctors. It lied to doctors. It lied to patients. So whatever responsibility comes with that, and this is stuff that they've admitted, it rests on their shoulders. That's the responsibility that they bear.
Mm. So, again, at the crux of your recent reporting here is a previously unknown Department of Justice report that some federal prosecutors wanted to press very serious criminal charges against at least three of the top execs at Purdue Pharma. I mean, they had been investigating Purdue for, 4 years, since roughly 2001, 2002, right?
That's absolutely correct. This investigation began in late 2002. It went for 4 years. During the course of the investigation, they went through millions of Purdue documents. They interviewed Purdue officials. And at the end of the investigation, they came to a very simple conclusion. And that conclusion was that this company knew that that OxyContin was being abused. There was significant evidence of it. And they believed that the corporate executives of the company should be held to account for that.
Personal account, right?
That's absolutely correct. They should be charged as individuals with a series of serious felony crimes.
Right. I mean, that's the stunning thing about it. I keep using this word over and over again, but I can't help it because I think for a solid decade, we have heard a collection of voices out there asking, why has no pharmaceutical company executive been personally charged with with allegations that could have led to a jail sentence? And yet here we find out the DOJ came awfully close to that. What happened? Why were those charges never filed?
There's a journalist named Jesse Eisinger who wrote a book called The Chicken Club. It came out last year, and it was basically about the unwillingness or inability of the Justice Department to charge corporate executives with serious crimes. Look, if it was me or you or any of your listeners today, we probably would be in prison by now. We would have been charged with these crimes. But there is a type of back scratching that goes on between top Justice Department officials and big name corporate defense lawyers because, 5 years from now, that Justice Department official is going to be on the other side of the table. He's going to be arguing to defend a corporate executive. And so you had people like Rudolph Giuliani and Mary Jo White, very high-profile former federal prosecutors who went in to argue this case or who represented Purdue or advised Purdue or its executives. And these top executives just folded, the top officials of the Justice Department.
So what you're saying... Well, let me back up here for a second and just note to listeners that we do realize that this is a family show. So, Barry, I'm sorry about the title of that book. Just don't repeat it again. That's all right. We don't want the FCC to get on our case. But look, the intensity and importance and passion around this issue sometimes things are going to slip here on the radio. Barry, what you're getting at is that lawyers from Purdue Pharma, including at that time Rudy Giuliani, who you're saying was representing them, met with the DOJ and said whatever they said. And all of a sudden, coming out of the other end of that meeting, the Department of Justice at the highest levels told the U.S. attorney in charge of this investigation, John L. Brownlee, that what, they wouldn't support his prosecution?
That's correct. So essentially what the document shows, the report that is in Painkiller and I wrote about in the Times, shows that the case prosecutors and John Brownlee, who is the U.S. attorney in charge of the case, forwarded the recommendations for indictments to Justice Department headquarters. I learned through reporting that mid-level officials within the Justice Department supported these indictments. But it was only when a meeting took place between Purdue's defense team and the top officials of the Justice Department, people who were political appointees, that, you know, the outcome of that meeting was simply the message being sent to John Brownlee that they were not going to provide him with resources, with whatever he needed to move forward with this prosecution. So he was essentially left to twist in the wind.
So they ended up going for those misdemeanor charges, which Purdue settled on.
Correct.
For the $600 million fine.
Correct. I mean, essentially, he told someone who he spoke with shortly before this plea deal was struck that, you know, he didn't have the resources to take on Purdue. I mean, Purdue had unlimited financial and legal resources, and John Brownlee had this small, tiny team of prosecutors who had worked night and day to build this case, and they were just going to get steamrolled.
Well, so given all this that we know now, this afternoon I went back and watched some testimony that U.S. Attorney Brownlee gave before the Senate Judiciary Committee on July 31st, 2007. You know this testimony very well, I'm sure, because it was a hearing on the appropriateness of the misdemeanor charges and pleas regarding Purdue Pharma. And I just want to play some tape for listeners here, because it's remarkable to hear this, knowing what we know now. So first of all, here is U.S. Attorney John Brownlee's a moment from his opening testimony.
These convictions have confirmed what many believed for a long time, that Purdue's marketing of OxyContin was deceptive and criminal. It is important to note that most of the people never claimed that Purdue was solely responsible for their loved one's death. They just wanted Purdue to tell the truth about the drug. The investigators and prosecutors who built this case have brought that truth to light.
Did the whole truth come to light, though? I mean, not until now, right?
Yes. John Brownlee really worked hard on this case. His prosecutors killed themselves on this case. But he was essentially in a no-win situation. I mean, if you go forward in that tape, he is being pressed very hard by Senator Arlen Specter, a Democrat of Pennsylvania who has since died.
Well, we have two more pieces from that exchange. I know exactly the one you're talking about.
Okay.
And it's interesting because actually at this time, Arlen Specter was still a Republican because I think he moved over to the Democratic
right.
Party in 2009. But so I want to play this because you're exactly right. It is bracing. So I've got two little segments here. This is, again, the now late Senator Arlen Specter, who was then the Republican co-chair of the Judiciary Committee, really laying into Brownlee, saying, I mean, he doesn't really do this, but you can almost imagine him throwing up his hand saying it makes no sense if the government says that it had evidence of wrongdoing against execs at Purdue Pharma that it didn't pursue more serious criminal charges. Here's Specter.
There's a total disconnect. Either you have a basis for saying that there is an intent to mislead or you don't. And if you have a basis for saying there's an intent to mislead, it's because individuals acted in a way which led you to that conclusion. And that being so, I do not see how you can have a conclusion that the individuals weren't wrongdoers who deserve jail.
And so there's a lot of back and forth on that point, and Brownlee tries to explain his way out of that contradiction, but then Specter really pins him down.
Well, could you prove that any individual had the intent to mislead?
We did not charge any individuals with the intent to mislead.
I understand you didn't charge them. That wasn't my question.
Yes,
my question was, couldn't you prove that some individual had an intent to mislead?
The evidence in this case was reviewed by career prosecutors investigators, and it was their judgment, and I agree with them, that under the evidence in this case, that the charging decisions, the felony for the company and the strict liability misdemeanors for the executives, were the appropriate charging decisions.
Barry Meyer, what do you make of that?
Well, two things. One is that John Brownlee is, you know, trying to dance away from the obvious question. The second one is that John Brownlee was at that point trying to launch his own political career and was poised to run for Attorney General of Virginia. And the third part is that further on in the tape or in the transcript which I read, Spector tries to pin him down further and asks him about the evidence. And John Brownlee says, I can't discuss the evidence. Mm. It's basically covered by grand jury secrecy.
Right.
And what he is talking about is the evidence that is contained in the report, which I obtained and read and wrote about both in Painkiller and in The Times. And that is this extraordinarily damning evidence. And had he been able to speak of that evidence in 2007, it would have been explosive, because there would have been no doubt that, you know, from his perspective, these weren't the appropriate charging decisions. In fact, the appropriate charging decisions that he wanted to make were felonies.
Hmm. Now, is this all happened, the misdemeanor plea and settlement came in 2007. And it's a painful isn't even the right word, tragic irony when you look at the growth of OxyContin sales and revenue and the number of prescriptions in the following years, right? I mean, I was seeing some numbers that showed between roughly 2007 to 2010, the sales of OxyContin rose from $1 to more than $3 billion. So I guess, are you headed down the road of saying that if more serious charges had been brought, we can't help but to wonder if there could have been an earlier curb to the vast availability of this very powerful prescription drug?
I don't think there's any question about it. And I don't think it's strictly limited to OxyContin. I think had the evidence that the government gathered been put on public display, regardless of who won this trial, regardless of whether the government won or the executives won, there would have been an awakening. There would have been a realization by doctors of how profoundly they had been deceived. They would have had far more information about opioids than they had. You know, it wasn't just the prescribing of OxyContin that continued to go up. It was all the other powerful narcotic drugs. And we would have been in a situation in 2007 where doctors probably would have started treating pain in other ways. So, you know, the unfortunate circumstances that continued to cascade from this decision were tragic, and in my view, they were avoidable.
Well, so once again, I just want to reiterate that Purdue Pharma sent us a statement, which I gather is probably similar to one they sent you, in which they say Purdue Pharma is committed to addressing the opioid crisis, and we support a number of public health policies that are designed to stem the tide of opioid-related addiction and limit prescribing. And for more than 15 years, they say they've led industry efforts to help address prescription opioid abuse, which includes developing medications with abuse deterrent properties, et cetera. We recognize that more needs to be done, and we continue to pursue a range of solutions that will have meaningful impact to help address this national public health crisis. That's a statement, excerpts from a statement from Purdue. I mean, ultimately, Barry Meyer, you know, I remember in 2007, there were members of the federal government who said that a message was sent with that $600 million fine. So do you think, knowing what we know now, though, that is anyone in the government, we have some state-level cases against companies like Purdue Pharma, are people going to be examining all this closer once again? Do you think charges may ever be brought against executives individually?
Well, certainly there's the opportunity to bring charges against executives of other drug companies. I mean, these particular charges have been resolved where the Purdue executives mm-hmm. are concerned. But I think it's fundamentally important for the federal government to hold corporate executives to the same level of justice and scrutiny that a drug dealer on the street is held to the same level of scrutiny that you or I or any of your listeners would be held to. It is really time for special treatment of corporate executives to be over. You know, allowing them special treatment was a contributing factor to this horrible public health disaster that we are now confronting. And if we want to try to, you know, to solve it, that is one policy that has got to end.
Well, Barry Meyer is a former reporter with the New York Times. His recent reporting about what the Justice Department knew regarding what Purdue Pharma executives knew about the abuse potential of OxyContin. All that reporting in the Times is linked to our website, or we've got a link to it at our website, radioboston.org. And I also want to say that Barry's author of Painkiller, An Empire of Deceit and the Origin of America's Opioid Epidemic. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you, Barry. Thank you so very much for your reporting.
Thank you, Meghna. I greatly appreciate it.
Listeners, let us know what you think about all this. Send us a comment at radioboston.org or a tweet at Radio Boston. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. For weeks now, we've been hearing stories about migrant parents who cross the U.S. border, the U.S. southern border, illegally with their children and then being separated from their children. It's all part of the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy, as it calls it, on illegal immigration. And here's Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking in an interview with conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt last week.
We don't want to do this at all. If people don't want to be separated from their children, they should not bring them with them.
Well, the Boston Globe's political reporter Liz Goodwin went to McAllen, Texas, to see exactly what's going on with these parents and their children, or at least to find out as much as she could. She wrote a gripping story about it over the weekend. It appeared in the Globe. Its headline is, Down on the Border, There's a New Trail of Tears. And Liz joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, you went to McAllen, Texas. First of all, I mean, for folks who haven't been there, I mean, describe why you went there and what did you see?
Yeah, so McAllen is the busiest corridor right now for people, especially from Central America, coming up and trying to claim asylum here. When I was there just in the morning, there were 72 migrants that Border Patrol, the marshals, brought to the courthouse to get their misdemeanor charge for the first for their first crime of entering, you know, the border illegally. And that's part of this zero tolerance policy. And that was just in the morning. Mm. There were another 72 in the afternoon. So it's just kind of the hotbed right now of the zero tolerance policy and the effects of that on children.
Yeah. You know, I actually have to say I'm grateful that you said that many of these families are seeking asylum, because in the introduction, I just said crossing the U.S. border illegally. And that's too broad a brush here, because you know, they're appearing at the border without documentation. Some of them are requesting asylum, which is not an illegal act. There is a process by which the U.S. or any government processes and handles asylum seekers. So what's going on there, though, with parents and their children? Because in years past, families were kept together even as they went through the asylum process, were they not?
Yes. So basically, the federal government is within its rights to charge even asylum seekers with a misdemeanor. I think no one's disputing that that's illegal or that you can't do that. You just have to give them a chance to apply for asylum after that as well, unless they're going to a port of entry and asking for asylum there. So basically, in the past, the idea of splitting up families was just kind of beyond the pale, unless there was a situation like, you know, the child, there was a suspicion that the child did not belong to that adult or something like that, an actual custody issue. So a lot of times, administrations would keep the family together and have them do their asylum claim first. So it would just sort of be like, okay, you can go into either this family ICE detention facility or be released and go to your court date, see if you get asylum. If you don't, we're going to send you back. It's going to be a removal. And then basically if they wanted to charge that person also with a federal mm-hmm. misdemeanor for illegal entry, that would be time served because they've already been in detention for a few days and misdemeanors don't come with big jail time. It's a very minor offense. So this seems to be a purposeful way to redirect that, have the punishment on the front end, get the children separated as an extra punishment, and kind of get the word out that, you know, if you come, it's going to be hell. Don't come. Don't make this journey. Because, you know, people coming has increased threefold from last year. So there is a big increase in the number of migrants coming, and the Trump administration is not happy about that. They're trying to think of ways to slow that down.
So, Liz, I have to say, there's a moment in your story which I just it made my heart drop to the pit of my stomach here, where you quote a lawyer who's representing some of these migrants who said that some of the parents were told when they arrived that their children were being taken to bathe and then only realized hours later that they weren't going to see them again.
Yes. So I think one of the most surprising things for me reporting out this story was that there's really no process for how the Border Patrol separates parents and children. And it's really kind of a gruesome thing to do. You know, a lot of these kids are very young. And so I think there's kind of, you know, sometimes it's handled where they'll explain to the kid and the adult together and they'll get to say goodbye. And, you know, there's a flyer with information they give to the adult. Some of those flyers have had inaccurate information. But and other times it seems to be handled in kind of a sneakier fashion where they'll say, oh, yeah, we just need your kids for a minute. They're going to go to this other part of the facility where the showers are. And then it just turns out that they've actually taken the kids to be picked up by HHS, which is where unaccompanied minors are taken care of. And, you know, I ran that by DHS and I said, you know, I've heard this and I've heard this. And is there a standard procedure for how children are separated from their parents? And they didn't dispute those details at all. And they also didn't answer my question about the standard procedure. So this isn't something that like ICE is denying or Border Patrol, really. They aren't denying that this has happened.
You spoke with you feature the story of a particular child who was separated from his parents. Will, can you tell us? I mean, what was Will like?
Yeah. So it's very hard to get any sense of what happens to the children once they're separated from their parents because they're deemed unaccompanied minors. They go into this very intense federal system that has a lot of privacy controls for good reason. You know, they don't want, you know, kids without their parents' permission talking to reporters or strangers or whatever. But it did create, I think, a lot of concern among people. You know, Senator Merkley went down to the border and tried to get into a shelter and wasn't allowed in. And there were a lot of questions about what happens to these kids. Are they okay? So I was just trying to get in touch with a child who was in HHS care, who had been separated, and a foster agency, Bethany, which is a Christian group that trains people to temporarily foster some of these kids. They volunteered to let me talk to parents and hear some of the stories, foster parents, mm-hmm. and hear some of the stories. So this couple took in this 6-year-old boy from Honduras. He showed up in Michigan, late night airport flight from Arizona border shelter, and was wearing, you know, giant sweatshirt, Crocs, which is kind of the uniform the Border Patrol gives the kids. And he, you know, barely talked for a few days. He was just so distraught. And now he's doing better. He now has 3 other foster siblings, all of whom were separated from their parents at the border and have no idea where they are. And Will is kind of coming out of his shell more. But he's still a 6-year-old boy without his mom or dad. So he has nightmares every night. He'll usually do really well during the day and enjoy school and time with his foster siblings, but then at night he'll get kind of anxious and cry. He has, you know, a picture of his mom and dad printed out from the internet, taped next to his bed, and he kisses them both goodnight. It's just really sad stuff, and just kind of gives you a sense of, you know, the Trump administration talks about this policy as if it's just a side effect of zero tolerance. Like they don't want to own the child separation part of their policy. So I just wanted to kind of show how it affects real people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as you write in your story, the last time Will saw his father was when his father was taken away in handcuffs, and hasn't seen him since. Well, Liz Goodwin is a political reporter with the Boston Globe. Her story, Down on the Border, There's a New Trail of Tears. We've got a link to it at radioboston.org. Liz, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me on.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.